And he'll also pull the screen up out of the way.
Thank you.
Thanks. No, we didn't think of that.
Jeez.
My heart came to attention.
Okay, Lisa. Is there anybody else out in the hallway? Okay. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for joining us today. I think we will go ahead and get started, and as others need to come in, they can get signed up. This is a public hearing concerning the complaint filed by Mr. Al Kollwitz under the State Election Code in accordance with Section 1-1.5-105. This is a hearing on record. Therefore, the hearing is being recorded, and all materials submitted shall be part of the official record. So anyone that will be testifying, you'll need to come up to the podium and speak into the microphone so that everyone's able to hear. The date is May the 24th, 2006, and I have 1:35 p.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room at 1700 Broadway on the second floor in Denver, Colorado. I am Secretary of State Gigi Dennis, and I'd like to introduce the following persons sitting at the table with me today who will be assisting in the hearing. To my right, we have Mr. Bill Hobbs. He is the Deputy Secretary of State. Wayne Munster is the Acting Elections Director. John Gardner is the Voting Systems Specialist for the Secretary of State. Monica Marcus, she is the Assistant Attorney General. Also, our lady in red there at the table assisting is Rita Famert. Rita will help assist if any of you have something to submit for the files today. You can hand it to her, and she'll make sure that it is distributed to us. The Secretary of State received this complaint on April the 10th of 2006. The complaint was assigned a tracking number of SOS-HAVA-01-06-0001. The complainant alleges that the Hart eSlate voting systems have been wrongfully certified for use in Colorado based on two specific allegations that the system violates state and federal law. The two alleged violations are the following. One, that the eSlate system does not provide anonymous voting because the VPAT, or the Voter Verified Paper Audit Trail, is printed on a continuous paper roll, and that knowingly the sequence of the voters enables one to know each voter's vote. Number two, that blind voters cannot verify the votes selected by the voter on the VPAT and therefore cannot detect errors on the printed ballot. As required by the Colorado Revised Statutes 1-1.5-105, paren 2K, my office conducted a preliminary review of the complaint after it was submitted. From this preliminary review, my staff concluded that it is unclear whether the complainant actually meets the legal requirements for a HAVA complaint established in Section 1-1.5-105. Specifically, it does not appear from the complainant itself that Mr. Kollwitz was personally aggrieved by or that he personally witnessed a violation of Title III as required by Section 1-1.5-105 subparent 2B. Nevertheless, I determined that the complaint presented important questions I wanted to consider and to address, even if the complaint did not meet the technical requirements of the law. Under Section 1-1.5-105-1G, Colorado Revised Statutes, a complainant may request a hearing on the record. In an email to the Secretary of State on April the 22nd, 2006, Mr. Kollwitz requested a hearing of public record. In addition, I have determined on my own that I wish to have a full public hearing on record concerning these important issues. As Secretary of State, I am committed to ensuring that HAVA disabled voter provisions, the most expansive in history, are implemented for Colorado voters who in the past might not have voted because doing so was too difficult. Our office is working with the state's county clerk and recorders to ensure that voters with any access concerns can be assured their votes will count and the privacy of the ballot box will be preserved for them. Thank you. And one of the important elements of the Help America Vote Act is to provide citizens with an orderly way to raise questions about elections. This hearing today is representative of a process by which voters across the state who are impacted by new rules, new equipment, and new procedures can address issues that directly impact them. I appreciate the concerns by the complainant in this hearing. We take these issues very seriously. The privacy of a voter is one of the most important principles of our democracy. Protecting that privacy is critical to maintaining confidence in our electoral process. I am very sorry for the space in this room that it is not adequately accommodating everyone. We had tried previously to get a larger hearing room, not really knowing what interest this might bring, but the Capitol, with their construction going on, could not accommodate us. So for those of you who have to stand in the back, I'm sorry for that. I would like to reiterate, anyone who's interested in testifying, you do need to sign up prior to testifying, and that is done over here at the table. Let's see, restroom facilities are up on the third floor, so you do have to go to the elevators and go up to the third floor to access those accommodations. Testimony must be limited to the two specific allegations of the complaint: printing the paper record on a continuous roll of paper violates a voter's right to secrecy, and or visually impaired voters cannot verify their votes to the VPAT without assistance. If you do testify, please do not raise other issues or discuss other issues pertaining to voting. These are the only two issues that we are addressing today at this hearing. And again, we'll need you to speak into the microphone over here to your left. Testimony may be submitted in written form. In the interest of time, it is not necessary to read any of your written material. If you turn it in to us, I'll guarantee you it will be read. In the interest of conducting the hearing and within the time allowed, time limits may be imposed on the testimony if necessary. My office has prepared a tentative schedule for the hearing. Copies were on the back table. I will just ask in general if anyone sees concerns with what we're looking at for a time sequence. I hope to have this all adjourned by 5 o'clock this evening. In the back, I see a cane raised. Is that there a question? Okay, thank you. All right. Based on this schedule, I'd like to first call upon John Gardner. As I had introduced in the beginning, he is our voting equipment specialist and has taken the lead in the certification of the HART equipment. John, I'd like for you to begin, and if you could provide any relevant information that you have that may pertain to the two allegations in the complaint. Mr. Gardner, I would ask that you cover the following. What are your duties within the Secretary of State office? What are the legal requirements for certification, both state and federal? How does the certification process work? What specific standards are followed in the certification process pertaining to laws or rules? For the eHeart Slate system specifically, when was this tested? Were there any special considerations or issues? And did or does the certification process take into consideration the issues raised in the complaint? I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I will try to address all of those issues as you have requested. I'd like to start, though, just to give some background information, and this will cover some of the things. In our Title I, there is a definition of a voting system. And that definition says that a voting system is a process of casting, recording, and tabulating votes using electronic devices or ballot cards, and includes, but is not limited to, the procedures for casting and processing votes and the hardware, firmware, printouts, and software necessary to operate the voting system. So you see we have a component of a voting system here, the eSlate, and the accessory devices necessary to run it. But when we do certifications, we consider the definition of the voting system as a whole. So it's a whole package. And part of that package includes the process, as it mentions in the definition, processing votes and procedures necessary to conduct an election. So with that said, I'll talk about my duties specifically. Here, I am the voting system specialist for the Secretary of State, and it is my primary duty to certify and process the equipment through the certification process and then make a recommendation to the Secretary of State on approving or not approving or approving with conditions certifications of voting systems. I have been here for 11 months, and in that time we've processed four systems. We have two more in the hopper coming up now, and that is my primary duty. So studying, understanding what we have in our state law, what the federal government is doing is all part of that, as well as actually conducting the tests, which I'll describe next. Pursuant to our Title I, Section 15608.5, any electronic voting system that's used in the state must first pass a federal certification. Thank you. Additionally, we have Secretary of State Rules 36 and 37 that provide additional detail to mandating that the Election Assistance Commission, the EAC, certify specifically prior to our state certification. So any electronic system must be federally approved and tested prior to our state certification process. Our process is defined mostly by the statutes, sections 15615 through 15620. And specifically, we were granted authority to define the specifics for certification. We defined those in Rule 45, and we also have a procedures document which shows the specific tests that we're going to conduct for certification. We have over 600 requirements to be tested. All of these are covered in Title I and in our Secretary of State rules. The details of all that is posted on our website. We have the charts that are in place, the procedures, and the exact rule that we're following. And specifically, these tests are functional requirements. And what that means is we're processing ballots. We're setting up elections. If you look at the procedures, you'll see we test a primary and we test a general or a coordinated election scenario. We provide the vendors with details to the way we want that election set up that generates specific scenarios. And at the end of the day, when we're done, we will run well over 10 to 15,000 ballots through each device. An eSlate device, such as this sitting here, a DRE, because of all the different types of tests that we do, we'll have 700 or 800 ballots put through it. We want to know how many ballots before the VPAT runs out of paper, or how the audio component works, and we might have to do ballot after ballot after ballot in order to cover all the different tests and the scenarios that we've created to ensure that all those things are working. Also, the tests and the results of the test consider the election process and the voting device working in harmony with the rest of the voting system. So what I mean by that, we look at memory cards. This is just an example. Every device that's electronic has some kind of memory card that's put in place, and we have tests that look at the seals and how that seal is kept from voters accessing the memory card or tampering with the device, but we also take into consideration the chain of custody. What logs does the election official have to create when they seal the machine, and what is the chain of custody of that seal number or lock throughout the process? And again, that's just one example. There's many of these things. We look at access to the voting system. Who has access to the device? When does the judge pick it up from the warehouse at the county? Is it the day before? Is it put in place prior to the election at a school? All those things we take into consideration when we look at access to the voting system. We also think of the privacy of voters. How are the machines set up in the polling place? If a voter walked by, could they see how you're voting in the middle of that? Do we make recommendations in the certification about the machine must be set at this angle or this direction as voters are walking in? Things like that. We're constantly considering the process of the election in addition to actually processing votes on the election. All of those process and procedures take between 45 and 90 days to complete, so it is a bit of a time-consuming process. Specifically with Hart's system, this is system 6.0. They applied for certification to the state on January 11th. On February 13th, we were prepared to start the functional testing. There's quite a bit of time up front where we have to review the documentation to ensure that the system can apply and can proceed to the functional testing. And it's interesting to note, at the beginning of the functional testing, we have a three-day period. This is a maximum of 3 days for the vendor to do a demonstration of the system, where they really kind of walk through all the pieces for us and kind of give us some instructions and show us. And this demonstration period is open to the public. We post that information on our website for 1 week prior to that date, and it's open for anybody that can come. And to note, with the Hart system, only one attendee other than the staff attended the demonstration, and it was not the complainant. I don't know if the person was a representative of them or not, but they didn't take advantage of attending. On February 28th, we made a recommendation to you to certify the system, and you agreed, and it was approved. Through the process of certification, we clearly identified that the VPAT does provide for anonymity and security of records as required by our state law when used properly in the election process. The VPAT, if you notice it's blank right now. The VPAT is the part on the left-hand side of the screen of the DRE. And what happens after a voter casts their record, they approve the paper record that matches the electronic record, and they press the cast ballot button, and that paper scrolls out of the way, so no other voter or election judge could see how a voter voted. And that whole device, the canister that holds the VPAT, is sealed and secured, and there's a chain of custody for that record of tracing to make sure that nobody has opened the VPAT canister. In addition to that, we will put in place with our rulemaking hearing in June, some additional rules that address the canvassing process and how to continue that chain of custody of the VPAT canister to protect the anonymity of the records and ensure that it's treated like regular paper, optical scan ballots, or other types of ballots. The information that's printed on the record is the voting information only. It contains the races, the results that were selected by the voter. It has the name and the date of the election. And then it prints a barcode at the bottom, and that barcode is essentially to be used for a recount situation if somebody wanted to quickly process those records. But that barcode doesn't contain any information that ties back to the voter or specifically to the poll book. That was one of the things we wanted to make sure, that the VPAT doesn't have anything that could tie back to the poll book record. So there's no way to figure out who did what or where. For the VPAT, specifically rule 45.5.2.9.10 is the rule that addresses the security and anonymity of the VPAT, and the procedure 9.3.4.6 is the test, the specific test that we use to look at the VPAT anonymity. Additionally, the disabled voters, audio ballots in particular, they are allowed to review their choices prior to casting a ballot, as it's required by our state law. Section 15704, paren 1N, describes the conditions for audio ballots that must be followed. And specifically, a audio ballot must allow the voter to review the candidate selections and prior to casting the ballot be able to change those selections and be provided information if they have failed to vote entirely or if they've undervoted a race. and the E-Slate system does all of those things as defined in our law, and thus the reason for recommending the certification to you. Additionally, I'd like to just point out, this is kind of separate from the HART system. There has been a lot of discussion, both in our office and with citizens, about ballot marking devices and use of ballot marking devices. And I just want to point out for the record that there is a unique situation in Colorado with our state law. It's 1-5704(1)(n). And this is specific to audio ballots. And it says that after the initial instruction from an election official, the elector shall be able to independently operate the voter interface device through the final step of casting a ballot without assistance. And when you talk about a ballot marking device, I mean, you have to recognize that it's just that. It marks a ballot. It marks a paper ballot. So getting the ballot to be cast requires the voter to take the ballot and go to another device, whether it be a ballot box or a scanner to be scanned in. So how do you get that stage to be cast without assistance is, you know, something I hope comes out of some of these discussions that we have in continuation. Thank you for the time to speak. I hope I addressed everything. And if not, I can address questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you, John. One question I do have is, can you explain what the AutoMark system is and why it was not certified?
Yes, ma'am. The AutoMark system is a ballot marking system that looks like a direct record electronic device, a DRE. A voter would go and select their choices on the screen, and the device will print and mark a paper ballot for you, and then you would have to take that ballot and get it cast, put it into a ballot box or a scanner to reach that final step. And essentially, the AutoMark device does not meet the requirement of this state law, 1-5704(1)(i), which I just read to you, which requires an elector to be able to independently operate the device through the final step of casting a ballot without assistance.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Next, I would like to call on Mr. Kollwitz. Al, if you'd like to come on up to the podium and welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting us to come and speak to you in this public hearing. I understand.
And
my name is Al Kollwitz.
Thank you. I just needed that part.
2867 Tin Cup Circle, Boulder, Colorado. I'm registered to vote in Boulder, Colorado. The first thing I wanted to do is to thank you, because I do understand that you called for this hearing despite some questions about the authority that I may have to bring the complaint forward. And I think it's really a wonderful thing that you've seen the bigger issue and focused on it and called this hearing, because we are dealing with very important issues. I'd also like to thank all of the people here that have taken time out of their lives to come and learn and testify in this hearing. The facilities are going to be a little tight, but I'm wondering if we do get more people, if you might put another row of chairs, possibly. First of all, one of the things that I'd like to say is that I am not a disabled person. I do not have a personal disability that causes me to come before you. I can tell you that I have a very close disabled person situation. My younger sister, has MS, and that has caused her to be blind at a very late age, only about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So I'm very sensitive to this situation. I can tell you that our objective is very clearly stated in our complaint, and I have handed out to you, I think, or will, a copy of the document. That has attempted to collect the facts in this matter. Now, this is a 12-page document. I know you don't want me to read this into the record. It's available electronically if you would like it. The document is available on the Camber website, and if you Google for Camber voting, you'll find the Camber site, and then just add the slash complaint dot DOC, doc, and you'll actually pull up the Word document. It's a little difficult to try to figure out how to proceed because there is so much to say on so little. It's a very narrow issue, and there's a lot to say. So I'd like to just give you a summary on the first page, which is page number 2, and then I'd like to go through the document and show you how to use it, if I may.
Okay.
On page 2, we reiterate and acknowledge that the Secretary of State has the authority and the duty to verify voting equipment for use in Colorado elections. And we cite the statutes that John just produced for us. We also say that the Colorado Secretary of State has wrongfully certified the Hart Intercivic eSlate Direct Recording Electronic, DRE, voting equipment. And as will be detailed below in the document, we recite, one, the eSlate does not provide for anonymous voting. Two, the eSlate does not permit blind voters to verify that their votes are correctly printed before they are cast. Three, testing of the eSlate was inadequate and failed to report these two defects. Four, unfair preferential treatment was given to eSlate multiple ballot per voter voting equipment over alternative federally certified voting systems that use a single paper ballot per voter. By multiple ballots per voter, that's a new phrasing perhaps to everybody in the room. I've tried to figure out how to distinguish between paper ballot systems and DREs in general and the Hart in particular. This class of equipment has not convinced the world that it is safe enough to trust the machine to record your ballots electronically only. Legislatures across the country are requiring that vendors add a printer to these devices because the people don't trust what goes into the machine. There are too many illustrations of malfunction. So this class of machine will have at least one digital record and sometimes three or four copies of that digital record, a paper record, and in addition, we learned today, or we don't learn today, I didn't learn today, but some of you may have learned today, that there is another record of vote, which is the barcode. The digital record cannot be verified by humans. We can't see it. We can't touch it. We can't, you know, get our hands on it. The barcode, if you were trained, you might be able to tell what it says, but almost everybody doesn't know what it says, so practically it's not verifiable. And the only verifiable ballot is the paper ballot that's written in plain text and available for access by a scanner that could go text-to-speech and read it to a blind voter. If I may continue on page 2, when certified voting equipment is found to be non-compliant, the Secretary of State is required to decertify the equipment. Every voter is disenfranchised when their vote is overridden by an ineligible vote. We ask the Secretary of State to stipulate items 1, 2, and 3, that is, the eSlate's not anonymous, the eSlate doesn't allow a blind voter to verify the paper, and testing of the eSlate was inadequate. We ask the Secretary of State to decertify the eSlate voting equipment, and we ask the eSlate to repair the damage that has resulted from the wrongful certification of the eSlate voting equipment. And by that I mean, time has been squandered to the point where election officials across the state of Colorado have precious little, if any, choice at this point, because the time has been squandered by those responsible for conducting this portion of the election integrity job. Now, I'd like to show you what's in the anonymous, what's in the rest of the document. On page 3, we describe in detail our issues with anonymous voting, our first point. On page 5, we describe in detail our problems with the voter verified voting. On page 7, we describe in detail the problems we have with the testing that was or was not done on the Hart e-slate. On page 9, we discuss the unfair and preferential treatment that was given to the multiple ballot per voting alternative over the single ballot per voter alternatives. And finally, on page 11, we describe what we think is the appropriate remedy. Page 12 is simply a recitation of some of the citations in the document. I've got how much time do you author? 2:45. I got 45 minutes. I think I can go through this and allow maybe allow you a minute to scan the pages 3 and 4 to see, and a little bit of 5, to see what we're saying in anonymous voting, and then actually summarize those points for you, and then see if there are any questions. So I'll be quiet for a minute.
Mr. Kollwitz, what do you recommend that can truly take place in place? I mean, this equipment has gone through federal certification as well as state certification. What recommendations do you have specifically that would meet that requirement?
I would recommend that the Secretary of State direct personnel to verify the details that we have provided in the document that we have given to you first. When you verify these details, I think you will find that it is not possible to protect the anonymity of a ballot from a voter. I think you will conclude that this is a direct violation of the laws that John cited. Second, I think if you were to have a team examine the details beginning on page 5 regarding voter verifiable voting, I think that you will discover that it is impossible for a blind voter to know what is printed on the VPAT as it is constructed. It is impossible. Therefore, it violates the federal and state law. I think that if you were to have a staff examine the testing, that you will discover, as we have, that no tests were performed, despite the fact that specific requirements for specific tests are called for in the procedures. I don't mean no tests were performed. No tests were performed of these two specific items. And that you've got an in-house problem because of that. And I don't know what to suggest to you about that. I mean, if you've got people getting paid to do a job that's not being done, that's so critical, then that's an internal management issue. On page 9, I think
on defense of my staff, they've done everything that they're supposed to do according to the law, Mr.
Okay.
Kollwitz.
I would like not to let that stand.
No. I'm not going to let you call down my staff for not taking their role and their job seriously. What I'm asking you then, do you know of any systems out there currently that can provide a visually disabled person to be able to verify what their vote is?
The system that John mentioned earlier, the AutoMark, allows the voter, a blind voter, a totally blind voter, to hear what is printed on the document. The vote pad, I have not seen, but I have read about and seen videotapes of, is a system that allows a totally blind voter to use the fingers and touch to to discover the marks that are on the ballot. So yes, there are two alternative systems.
Did you, back when the VPAT was discussed during the legislature in 2005, were you part of that discussion?
I'm certain that I would have submitted comments to the legislature before the legislation was enacted, and I may have sent a letter to the governor recommending that the governor veto a bill that would include certain elements of non-anonymous and non-verifiable voting.
Okay. Questions?
Oh. So, if I may, if everybody's had a chance to look at the first two pages that say that the ballot is not anonymous. Probably. There's a roll of tape on the edge of this machine. Between the horizontal black lines is a ballot and the votes that a voter selected. The first voter has the first set of black lines, the second voter has a second ballot, the third voter has a third ballot. Colorado law, in order to provide transparency, specifically authorizes poll workers to compile lists of voters in the precincts and in the voting places. Now, I, for one, find it almost not worth saying, but I will, that if I had a list of the names of the voters who voted in the sequence that they voted, and if I could get my hands on that tape, I would now have a list of everybody's votes. Now, the Colorado Constitution protects against this, and this was tested and decided by the Colorado Supreme Court in a case called Tyler versus Pyle. And the court basically brushed it off, saying, well, this is silly. Of course you have to be anonymous. And it's very clear. Now, anonymous means not only that somebody can't find out what you've done, but you cannot prove what you have done. That is to say, you can't write your name on this ballot or some little special mark on this ballot so that you can then later prove to somebody who wants to buy your vote that that's the way I voted. Or to prove to somebody who is intimidating you, I can prove how I voted. So the Colorado Constitution and the Colorado statutes are not at all permissive. They are not. It's okay to have marks on the ballots as long as nobody tells. It doesn't say it's okay to have marks on the ballots or you're able to lose anonymity as long as the Secretary of State promises not to disclose the records. We have a situation, for example, yesterday where 26 million identities walked out of a office on a disk and went home to some well-meaning employee who was robbed. And the disk and his computer are gone, as well as 26 million identities. If you never create the opportunity for the loss, you will never lose it. This machine, as it's constructed, does create the opportunity for the loss, and it is not good enough that good intentions intend that nobody will disclose this. If I may give you half a minute or a minute to scan pages 5, 6, and a little bit of 7. We'll talk about the verified voting for the blind.
You can address that if you want.
Mr. Colwitz?
Yes. Ready? Okay. With regard to voter-verified voting, the e-slate does not permit blind voters to verify that their votes are correctly printed before they are cast. Now, as I say, I think that's obvious. What it would mean if they were able to verify their printed ballots before they are cast, they would perhaps use technology such as a text-to-speak device that would independently read the content of the paper and produce it on an audio for the voter. Title III of HAVA requires that the voter be able to inspect the content. The Colorado statutes require that on and after June 6, 2005, a political subdivision shall not acquire a voting system unless the voting system is capable of producing a paper verified record of each elector's vote. And Colorado 11104.50.6 describes a voter verified paper record as an auditable paper record that is available for the elector to inspect and verify before the vote is cast, and suitable for a manual audit or recount. The definition of cast is not included in 11104. However, the requirements specified in CRS 15704-1N are as follows. And it describes in my document here exactly what it means to cast the ballot. So when John talks about the entire voting system or the entire voting process, the process starts when the voter is authorized to vote, having passed the test of eligibility, and the process ends when the voter submits the final anonymous ballot, the final, can't change it, I can't get it back and give you another chance because it's anonymous and I don't know whose it is anymore. It's gone. So the voting process starts with being authorized to vote and ends with casting your ballot. And all of the law, everywhere, HABA, election rules, Colorado statutes, all of it says that every voter is entitled to do that process privately, and it infers completely. This machine does not allow that to happen. It makes absolutely no provision, no imitation of a provision, no attempt at a provision to allow a blind voter to know what is on that paper. We know for a fact that that paper sometimes does not agree with what's inside of the machine, not for this particular machine, but for this class of machines. Secondly, we know for certain that sometimes when a machine is supposed to be printing, it's making noise, but it's not printing anything. A blind voter could not discover that. I don't know what more to say. A blind voter cannot understand what that machine has printed using the tools that are available. And that violates HAVA and the statutes and the election rules. I'll give you a minute if you like to look at page 7 and 8 and a little bit of 9 regarding the adequacy of the testing. And I apologize if I came on attacking staff. I didn't mean that. And if I did mean it, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it.
Thank you.
Madam Secretary, could I ask Al a follow-up question?
Please.
Absolutely.
Mr. Kollwitz, I'd just like to know, you mentioned two statements about this class of voting system. By class, I assume you mean a direct record electronic voting device with a VPAT attached. Is that correct?
Yes, that's good enough. It's that kind of machine. Yes, John.
Okay. You also mentioned that you have documents showing where the VPAT doesn't print a record.
No, I said we have experience with other printers that printers have run out of ink or their thermal needles have jammed or frozen up or some. And I was explicit. I don't have specific cases for this equipment per se.
Okay.
This is a generality.
Okay.
It's a source of distrust for voters. It's a problem that can happen. Therefore, we prepare for it. And therefore, we're not going to be hurt by it.
Do you have documented proof of the generality that you mentioned?
I can find a case where a printer has run out of ink, or I can find a case
in
where
your experiences, where you were witnessing and part of the examination of that machine or whatever use of the machine.
I'll have to look. I mean, okay. I'm running from memory.
Sure. And also, you mentioned wrong results were printed on the VPAT. Do you have documented proof
again,
of that?
Again, if I said that, I erred. I meant to say that this class of machines has experienced situations where the results that were recorded on the binary records recorded in memory did not match the results that were printed on the printer.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Mr. Kollwitz, my concern has to do with, you know, there are other ballots in a clerk's office where they are going to know how an individual voted. There's a provision in the statute that allows for faxed ballots to come in emergency situations. Someone would have to take that ballot off of a fax machine. They would know by the signature to verify that they were a registered voter within their county. And if that employee happened to know that individual by name, they would know they would know how that ballot was voted. How is that any different than a disabled person not being able to verify how they voted on a machine or that someone else saw what their vote was cast? Even though I agree, we try so hard to make sure that everybody has a private vote.
I guess I would recite three things. Number one is the legalese kind of a response, which is to say that's not related to what we're dealing with. But I want to go further than that. This machine would ultimately be used by all voters, not just disabled voters, in a precinct or a voting center. Everybody. The case of a fax ballot, we have officially complained, tried to persuade against, lobbied against the use of the fax ballot. The fax ballot has been argued to us that it's an option that the voter can take. This machine, that's not an option. You vote. You vote on that machine. If you don't like giving up your privacy, tough, don't vote. That was done in Boulder. That was done in Boulder. A voter didn't want to submit a mail ballot in an envelope containing his name and information. The clerk refused his ballot. Voter lost his vote. So we don't want that. We want voters' anonymity to be protected, period. If somebody wants to change the Constitution, we will fight with them, but the mechanism exists. It's our duty as people who care, and we hope the Secretary of State, to enforce the current existing provisions of the Constitution and the law. With regard to Bill?
Mr. Hobbs?
Well, I just wanted to follow up with some, I'm trying to get a real practical understanding of how the voter secrecy will be violated specifically with this equipment. And what I think I heard you say was that if you had access to that tape and if you knew the order in which people voted, then you'd be able to match the two and associate their votes.
That's correct.
And how would that happen? How would you get access to that tape and how would you find out the order in which people voted?
About 3, 4, 5 years ago, I can't remember exactly when, I purchased from Boulder County a list of 60,000 voter signatures. Not voter names printed out, but I mean their signatures. Photocopies of their signatures. 60,000 of them. Now, before I did this, you would sit across that table and ask me, how could I have done that? And who would have ever guessed that I could simply do it by walking up to the clerk and saying, may I buy this? She said, sure, $50. I now have control of all absentee ballots for 60,000 people because I can transpose those signatures onto ballots. With regard to that tape, the tape exists, therefore it is accessible. If somebody were to ask the VA, how would anybody get a hold of our identity information? It's private. It's protected. It's locked. It's password protected. It's secure. We promised to never do it. It's against the law. It's also released, 26 million of them. It must not be allowed to exist.
If I could follow up,
yes.
What I think I hear you saying is really this is just a general problem with all election systems. So, for example, I suspect that with a regular paper ballot system, when people vote in order and the ballots are cast and placed in a ballot box, if they fall in order, then if you know the order in which people vote and you have access to the ballot box, I assume you can associate how people voted as well. Is that correct?
That I'm going to have to say is unrelated. I mean, there are provisions for sorting the documents, I mean, shuffling the documents. I mean, everything is prescribed. Whether somebody could do that, you bet. Whether it's controllable, probably you bet. Whether this is controllable, probably not. And the reason that the precinct box is more likely to be controllable is that all of the time that box is sitting there, it's got a key on it, and it's got competing candidates and competing people looking at it. And the only time it's opened is in the front of competing people. So I wouldn't say that that's a surety by any means.
Continue, Bill.
Well, I probably need to ask, because I was a little confused about the tape versus the canister, and I don't know whether it's a question for Mr. Gardner or not, because what I was focusing on was the canister, which Mr. Gardner said was a sealed canister like a ballot box. So someone would have to have access to that canister was the way I understood it. Now,
I don't know. We were unable to really see this equipment, so my entire knowledge of it comes through a number of demonstration videos and a video that was prepared by one of the people that I work with who observed from a great distance a demonstration given by Hart.
May
go on to this testing issue, I'm going to run out of time.
One other quick question,
yes.
Though, just because we're right there. It seems like with respect to this machine, if there's one of these machines in a polling place, I think I follow your argument. But if there's two and people are being directed to alternate machines or whenever they're finished, I don't understand how you know how somebody voted. You've got two different rolls of paper and they don't associate with the order in which people voted.
The each machine has its own role, as we understand it, and individuals go to that machine or that machine, and the poll watcher could sit and watch and write down two lists for two machines, or have more than one poll watcher.
Okay.
With regard to inadequate testing, the testing failed to report that the eSlate does not provide the required anonymous ballot and does not provide the required means for blind voters to verify their votes on the printed ballots. Election Rule 45 spells this out. We asked for copies of the test documents from the Secretary of State. Specifically, they said, however, if you're requesting just those records of the Secretary of State relating specifically to the testing, quote, to verify that a blind voter can verify the votes recorded on the paper record of votes, parentheses, the audit trail in the case of the eSlate voting equipment, comma, and to verify that the eSlate provides anonymous voting, end of quote, then you're advised that there are no such records. We go on to assume that the tests were not conducted, otherwise there would be records. We say that the Secretary of State's procedures for certification explicitly call out a mandatory verification that the VPAT will allow verification on paper before the ballot is cast. That seems very clear. And documentation must show how the VPAT device allows the voter to review, accept, or reject or his or her record privately and independently. The procedure must verify whether a voter has a chance to verify privately and independently allow correcting the ballot before it's cast. The procedure must verify that the VPAT process is as close to the normal voting process as technically feasible for both able and disabled voters of all types. That seems very clear. There are no records. We must assume there was no test.
John, would you like to state again what the testing procedures were and that the public was invited to participate, and we did have members of the public that did observe and see the tests take place?
Yes, ma'am. The demonstration period was posted on our website for 1 week prior. It was open to the public. Any interested citizen, voter, could have attended, and only one chose to do so. I don't believe it was a representative of the complainant. Our test, as I mentioned, for, and these are included in our records, for disabled voters are straight out of Title I. It's 157041, I'm sorry, Parent 1, and describes how audio ballots are to be handled. And there's about seven things. Al quoted a couple of them, and there's some more here on my notes. Disabled voters must be allowed to review the candidate selections that they have made. The eSlate system does perform that function. Secondly, prior to casting a ballot, the voter must be able to change any selection that they have made, and the eSlate system does that. And also, the voter must be provided information if they have failed to vote or undervote for a candidate or a race, and the eSlate does that function as well. So looking at our procedures, and if we go through our test documents, there are specific documents for accessibility. There's test procedures for audio ballots, which come straight out of our statutes, and that's what we test, and all the tests passed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It perplexes me. If there were tests running, how could there be no records?
John?
The specific request was not tested, and I think that's the disconnect here, is that the request that we received was a very narrow and specific record that was being searched for that we truly didn't have. That test was not required.
Absolutely not true.
That test was not required based on our Title I statutes, and that's why our response was no record for that very specific request.
We have copies of the Secretary of State's voting procedures, and they are available on the web. And on the web, these two requirements are explicitly called out. And I don't have it in front of me, but we can identify it by number. And there are no results, no inputs, no outputs, no documentation, nothing. We have to assume that they were not tested. I'll go on to the next point, which is regard to unfair preferential treatment. Unfair preferential treatment was given to Eastlake multi-ballot per voter voting equipment over alternative federally certified voting systems that use a single paper ballot per voter. A competitor to the Eastlake, the Automark, was awarded federal certification on May 9, 2005, but denied Colorado certification on January 10, 2006. Colorado's reason for denial is written in the report here, but basically it's saying that a quadriplegic cannot move paper from machine to ballot box, essentially. And John mentioned that earlier. The statutes require that after the initial instruction from an election official, the elector shall be able to independently operate the voter interface device through the final step of casting a ballot without assistance. So John is making a point which is correct. A person who couldn't move a ballot might not be able to do this, moving of the ballot. The same way that a person who is totally blind cannot read what it says on that piece of paper. Our point is, why is one disability given a disadvantage over another? We believe that it's unfair. We believe that for all practical purposes, the inability for a blind person to read that paper is far no less important than the ability of a quadriplegic to move a piece of paper. And we detail that in our points here. And finally, on page 11, required decertification. When certified voting equipment is found to be non-compliant, the Secretary of State is required by law to decertify the equipment. Election Rule 45.9 says, after the Secretary of State has certified a voting system, it's determined that the voting system fails to meet the standards, the SOS shall notify any end users in the state of Colorado and the voting system provider of that particular voting system that the certification of that system for future use and sale in Colorado is to be withdrawn. Use of a decertified or uncertified voting system for any jurisdiction in the state of Colorado shall result and possible loss of future and other existing certifications within the state at the discretion of the Secretary of State. Now, although it has been certified by the Colorado Secretary of State, the Eastlake fails to meet the standards set forth in Election Rule 45. The Eastlake does not provide for anonymous voting. The Eastlake does not permit blind voters to verify that their votes are correctly printed before they are cast. And the Secretary of State is obliged and authorized to notify any end users in the state of Colorado and the voting system provider of that particular voting system that the certification of that system for future use and sale in Colorado is to be withdrawn. Now, we have this document as a submission. I would like your approval to add some documents to this based on the process here that we're going through, and I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Hobbs?
Let me follow up on your last point. If you're correct that the Eastlake system should be decertified, I was a little unclear. I think Secretary Dennis asked this before, but I'm not sure I understood the answer. If that system is decertified, those counties that are planning on using that system in elections this year, what are they supposed to do? Now, I think Automark, you mentioned as an example, but it's not certified. even if it were, I guess I'm also asking a practical question. What systems could be negotiated, acquired, and have poll workers train on them? Realistically, what are the possible alternatives for the two elections this year?
I've developed very complex systems during my career. One thing I've discovered, and maybe some others here have shared this, that schedules, which is what you're talking about, schedules, in my opinion, are missed not at the end, but in the beginning. And it's, you know, everybody gets this huge project and you spend the next weeks partying about the fact you won it and the system's 2 weeks late. What about the first 2 weeks? It's not the last 2 weeks, it's the first 2 weeks. So what you're bringing me is a question that says, okay, now we've gotten into this horrible mess, how are you going to get out of it? And I guess I could think about that, and I could and will, if you wish, offer an answer, but I won't do that, you know, off the top of my head. I have asked that the Secretary of State decertify the equipment because it does not comply with these two requirements, and these requirements are extremely important to voters and extremely important to the trustworthiness and the quality of our election system. And we ask the Secretary of State to decertify it and to do something to repair the damage, because you're right, contracts are being signed, equipment's being shuffled, people are being trained, and we can talk about what to do about that. But I would like to make sure that this happens, because this is a must. This is a must. We must decertify this equipment because it does not comply.
Mr. Hobbs.
I wanted to ask you also about the DOJ opinion. I know you're aware of this, but let me just explain the question. The Department of Justice does have a legal opinion out from 2003 that addresses, I think it addresses one of the VPAT issue that you're raising. And I'd like to just, it's one long sentence, but I'd like to read the official synopsis of that opinion and get your response to it. The synopsis of the opinion is, a direct recording electronic voting system, and I think it's describing this system here.
It's describing this system without a printer.
That produces a contemporaneous paper record, which is not accessible to sight-impaired voters, but which allows sighted voters to confirm that their ballots accurately reflect their choices before the system officially records their votes. That system, which does seem to me to be this system, would be consistent with the Help America Vote Act and with Title II of the Americans with Disability Act, so long as the voting system provides a similar opportunity for sight-impaired voters to verify their ballots before their ballots are finally cast. Which, and just to show that I'm trying to indicate my understanding here, what they mean is that the way the DRA works, every voter confirms their ballot before they finally cast their ballot. So it seems to me the opinion of the Department of Justice is that this system does meet the requirements of HAVA.
I'm familiar with that writing, and that writing has been outdated as a consequence of the innovations of verifiability, which have been introduced by text-to-speech on the paper record, which have been introduced into the voting arena through the AutoMark machine. And also, the Department of Justice person that wrote this has not written a refresh. He has not adjusted to the changes that have happened since then. And I've tried to reach him, but not been successful yet. I may mention also that you can swim around in all of the documents and find some very interesting things. For example, in the Election Assistance Commission's voluntary voting systems guidelines that will become the law some future. There are some statements in there that I believe that you will disagree with and I will disagree with, because nobody has really had a chance to really whack at it yet. And so the degree to which this DOG opinion has been hammered on, if I may use that kind of vernacular, is minimal.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Madam Secretary? I will be back.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Al. Mr. Kollwitz,
that is... Thank you for your time.
You bet. And it is permissible to go ahead and submit any other information you had, Al. I'd next like to call on Mr. Neil McClure, representing Hart InterCivic.
Thank you. My name is Neil McClure. I'm with Hart InterCivic, the manufacturer of the eSlate system. Appreciate the opportunity to address your panel. So the complaint is comprised of two components, as Al has covered here today. The first element relates to privacy and secrecy. And so I'd like to address that first, and then we'll approach the audio question. So the first element to understand is this is a ballot box. It's got a seal on it. It comes from the warehouse where the election workers put the paper in it. It's sealed, installed in the voting booth. And at the end of the day, when the polls closed, it's removed from the voting booth and transported back to a central location.
Clerk, can I interrupt just for 1 second? Just because we're broadcasting and people can't necessarily see what you're holding, This is really sort of a reminder for everybody. If you're referring to something in the room or whatever, if you kind of be a little more descriptive about what it is you're holding up.
All right.
For those that are listening in.
All right, my apologies. So I am holding up the eSlate VPAT unit. It's a plastic enclosure with a clear back that houses the paper roll and the print mechanism and the ability to connect it electronically to the DRE device.
Thank you.
So at the end of the day, this device is removed. It's transported back to a central location along with the electronic version of the records, which in our case are maintained on a memory card. So these two pieces of material are transported back centrally. There's no reason to open this in the polling location. It's set up so that if there is some paper outage or other problems, the whole unit is removed and replaced so that it is to remain sealed at all times in the polling location. So this is exactly like ballot boxes that we've been using for years for paper ballots. And as we move through the use of this device, at the end of the day, again, and I'll address this in a minute, but at the end of the day, the observable link between the VPAT unit and the voting booth in which it was installed is removed. Now, I would like to answer Mr. Hodges' question about how Mr. Kollwitz claims that privacy and anonymity is violated here. I happen to have been through this issue with him before in the Boulder County District Court, and I understand his concerns about this. I believe where he alleges that privacy and secrecy will be violated is that as an observer in an election location, a polling site, that you're able to keep track of the order in which voters cast their ballots. Subsequent to that, knowing that information or believing that you have correctly recorded that information, that you can then go and access, whether it's paper rolls or ballots with sequential numbers on them, back at the central location and equate what you believe was the correct order to what is found on the material back at the central location. So, you know, the way elections are set up and run, this presents some challenges to any one individual. In fact, just by the standard election practices and logistics, it would require a conspiracy. It would require more than one person because the access is different between in the polling location and at a central location. You could certainly be an observer during some post-election event as the paper rolls are being processed, but however, you would have to be able to keep track of where a ballot was on the paper roll. The other way to do it is if you had direct access to it. Well, to do that, you know, these are treated like ballots, and these ballots are not set out in the counter in the front of the election office when they're done with. They're stored and maintained. And even if you did record or believe that you accurately recorded the order in which people voted in a polling location, and even if you overcome the improbable likelihood of getting access to this information at the central location, even if you did all of that, even though laws would likely have been broken, what would you have? You would have this belief that you recorded the order correctly, and then you would have this claim that this is somebody's ballot. Well, this is absolutely no different than taking a ballot box full of ballots, reaching one out, pulling it out randomly, saying, oh, this is your ballot. There's no proof. There is no way to prove that the ballot on this tape is the one any particular voter voted. So hopefully this sheds some light on how this privacy and secrecy is violated. It relies heavily on being able to tie the order of voters through a voting booth and get that straight. But how do you prove that you recorded correctly? There's no way to do it. And likewise is true is once you've located a ballot on the paper roll, how do you prove that that was in fact that voter's? There's nothing that's provided in the system that allows you to do that. So on the matter of the audio, the voters that are visually impaired cast their ballots using audio. The voters that are visually impaired verify their ballots using audio. I find it interesting to note that Mr. Kolowitz suggests we add additional technology when we already don't trust what we have, but we're going to add more, and I believe he referenced speech to text. Well, are we going to trust that now? So at what point do we reach this position where we have something that we can trust? And I can assure you that this is a national challenge to meet these requirements for all of the different disabilities that are voters, for all of the different kinds of technologies that are available. It's a challenge nationally to come up with something to try and address the scope of community that voting systems must address. We personally have examined a variety of different technologies, but at the end of the day, we can't stand up here and give theoretical solutions. We have to fit within the requirements that are federal, that are state, local, and also to provide a usable product that provides a simple user interface so that voters with very little to no training can operate. So we have not reached this point lightly. We have examined a variety of technology. And to add speech to text is a complicated process. What he doesn't address in the speech to text component is that must be programmed as well. Because speech to text does a terrible job with proper names. And the majority of the information that you're communicating to the voters are proper names, and those must be phonetically spelled out. That's a huge, tremendous effort, and undoubtedly would result in lawsuits because somebody wouldn't like the way their name was pronounced. So, I mean, these are the realities, the challenges of trying to bring solutions to this state and others to support the requirements that are now mandatory for verification. That concludes my oral presentation. I do have a written testimony that I would like to submit, and I'll address any questions if you have some.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McClure. One question I have, and remember, this isn't a trial, so I'm just trying to find the facts out
okay.
here. But can you explain maybe a little bit of the detail that your company maybe went to in order to address the needs of the disability community when developing this equipment?
And this equipment, meaning the e-slate in general,
correct,
including this?
Correct.
I actually have volunteered engineering services since college to the disabled community. And so I have personally been involved on a volunteer basis over the years and have found that very rewarding personally. I had the opportunity to architect the e-slate system and bring a lot of the knowledge that I've learned over the years to provide an accessible interface. So we worked with the Colorado School for the Blind, we worked with Craig Hospital's Spinal Rehabilitation Center, numerous other national and local organizations to get feedback and input. The National Federation for the Blind, their International Braille Institute actually has an e-slate on display as an accessible interface, an example of an accessible interface. So we have done a great range of usability and working with disabled communities, not only with visually impaired, but from my experience, I had understand that physical disabilities were also a very important part, which is why we introduced the ability to navigate the ballot on the e-slate with using two external switches. And that can be that can include a sip and puff device. So we've gone very extensively through the user interface to provide one that's simple, one that that from our research would be one that was picked up quickly by the disabled by disabled voters and wouldn't need a great deal of training. That was a very important part of it. So, and we continue to get feedback, and you know, we run into various groups, various individuals that have, you know, specific improvements, and our challenge is to try and to take those individual ideas and merge them into an overall system, because there's a lot of competing interests and functionality that we have to consider before changing any part of our system. When we added the VPAT capability to it, one of the reasons why Access Magazine has rated the e-slate as the most accessible device available is because the visually impaired use the same physical interface as the sighted. That's a huge, huge desired attribute of our system. It's not a separate user interface. A lot of the touchscreens, one of the reasons we didn't go with a touchscreen technology is that it's not accessible. And so when we are using this interface that both the visually impaired and the sighted, is we're using the same interface when you're verifying your vote. So you make your selection, you review your selections, you can accept or cancel using the same interface that you voted with. So it provides a great deal of cohesive navigation without disrupting the process and creating a uniform flow in the voting experience for the disabled voter. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. That was helpful. Because now I'm wondering, do you have anything even to submit as record on record that would verify what you're saying as far as the acceptability by either the School of the Blind or the National Federation of the Blind or
Yes, ma'am. We have received numerous letters that were a result of reviews that have been performed by various organizations across the country. I can provide you with copies of those.
Okay, that'd be helpful. One of the concerns that I've had, which does not address how a visually impaired person could verify their vote specifically, but just from the standpoint that paper trail is in the case of a recount, that is the official ballot that we would be counting from.
Correct.
And so you don't want to allow people to have hands-on accessibility to it.
Correct.
So as you're looking at the technologies that you're developing, at some point in the future, will there possibly be a dual ballot almost as such, so that if there was one to touch, you could touch, but then there's an official one that would always be locked up? Or where does the technology go next from here?
Well, I certainly have a variety of opinions on that. And I'm involved with NIST on working on some of the new standards, the EAC as well. And so I'm, in fact, have monthly conference calls with them discussing this very topic. I can tell you one of the challenges with a cut sheet, that's the technology, a cut sheet, is that if you hand it to the voter, jeopardize the integrity of the audit. Cannot be assured that every voter will take their receipt or their ballot and deposit it. If you make that the official record, that the vote isn't counted unless it's in there, you can address that. You can address the integrity piece. But you lose a one-to-one capability of having a set of records that match. So that's a challenge. We looked at cut sheet technology that would allow you to print a record, cut it, and yet still reject it, and route it to another location if it were rejected. So all of the vendors, I can tell you, experimented with this technology. Epson makes this printer, and it was found to be completely unreliable. The paper always jammed, and it just was not a feasible solution. So we have, as a vendor community, I know, investigated these possibilities. There are many models that are being put together. There are many workshops that are investigating voting system models of the future. Certainly, what you describe is very similar to a carbonless paper receipt printer. However, you'll notice that carbonless paper receipts have gone away. The backup copy is now an electronic version. And NCR actually has a very extensive usability facility that I have visited to discuss this very issue with them. And they went through a real backlash from their customers when they got rid of the carbonless paper. The customers were afraid their records were going to be lost as well. But nonetheless, the market has evolved out of that, the receipt printer, and that's the most direct parallel. The problem with election technology is we don't have the volume nationally to create devices that are part of commercial off-the-shelf pieces. So we have to develop custom products, custom hardware. There are several models that are being discussed in various organizations, where you can collect the vote through one device and tabulate or evaluate it through another. My personal belief is that one of the reasons that we are undergoing this rather rapid change of adding paper trails is that we never stop to consider how to define a trusted computing device for elections. This is a device type that is used in other aspects of government where they have certain criteria that a device must met to be auditable and traceable, and the result is a trusted computing device. And this is one of the early debates, and when some of the cost got looked at on what it would cost to develop a trusted computing device, there was I think people ran for cover when they looked at the cost, and the result was the paper audit trail that came out. But I still believe that we can specify into the future what the design of a trusted computing device is and give vendors and manufacturers a target to shoot for. But as again, the frog model is probably the most famous one that came out of the Caltech MIT voting report. that's being discussed. I know there's a workshop in the middle of June at Georgetown University that is about voting system models. So there are a number of different organizations that are examining the model for the future for voting systems.
And then how many states do you currently have eSlate in? That has the VTAP.
We're certified in 22 states, and I believe that we have gone back and certified in 6 of those for VPAT.
Questions, committee?
Yes, I'd like to.
Mr. Gardner?
Mr. McClure, if you could expand on this device here, and this is called the judge's booth controller. This is the activator for the DRE. Mr. Kollwitz referenced a number that was printed out. Could you expand on how that number is used?
Sure. So the judge's booth controller will run from 1 to 12 voting devices. And when a voter comes in and is approved to vote, because this device can be used for election day, early voting, and for vote center operation, it provides you the opportunity to select which precinct or ballot style to assign that to the voter. And so the system generates a 4-digit random number that is simply a pointer to a ballot style in the system. The voter is then allowed to go to any available voting booth, enter that 4-digit number, and their ballot style will be presented to them, and they're then allowed to vote. This number has no relationship to the voter. There's nothing that connected as far as voter registration. It's simply an internal pointer that's used for traffic management, if you will, in the polling location and make optimum use of available voting terminals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hobbs, Monica? Mr. Munster?
Are any of the other 6 states with the VPAT struggling with the same issues that we are here today?
Not to my knowledge.
Thank you.
Mr. Hobbs?
If going back to the technology that would have to be added on the VPAT to provide the capability to read the ballot back to a visually impaired person. Do you have any idea what the cost of that technology would be?
Well, you would have to image. You'd have to have a CCD imager to create an image of the paper. And there are some new technologies that will allow you to do that with a digital camera. You then have to process that image into optical character recognition, which is machine code that it in itself has errors that are possible in the conversion from the image information into a ASCII text character, which is the format a computer understands. At that point, you would feed it into a text-to-speech converter that then has to read the letters, try to phonetically join them together, and produce the audio stream. Cost of that, it depends on your type of implementation, certainly, but the imaging piece and the processing software, I'm not sure I could give you a cost estimate on it that would be reasonable. I mean, you can get cameras that are very, very cheap, but then you get into the whole mechanical management of the paper issue, and that is one of the biggest challenges with this is managing the paper. And so if you had a cut sheet of piece of paper, certainly could feed it into a scanner, much like a copier, so it would have a document feeder, but then you would have the software that would have to image and process it. Certainly you would have to give it some information in order for it to know how to pronounce the names on the ballot. That's a whole other aspect where you introduce a reoccurring programming requirement for each election, much like defining a ballot.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes, if you'd submit that, Dan, you can hand it to Dana. And
okay.
See, I wanted... Is everybody ready for a break?
It's 3:10. Microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Would
you... I like for myself. I like that.
With the absentee ballot? Okay, thank you. I want to start with the folks representing specific organizations or groups. I put on the agenda to have a break. Let's go ahead and take a quick 15-minute break, so we will reconvene at 3:25. Like I said, the facilities are up on the third floor. The elevators are at the end of the corridor here. So we'll give everybody time to stretch just a minute. Thank you.
I don't. Sorry.
Do you have a highlighter?
No, I didn't. Just for your own.
Anna, do you have a highlighter on you?
Yes, I do.
Sometimes it sounds right, and sometimes.
Okay. Okay. Sure. Is she? Has she signed up to testify? What is her name?
And she could bring it up to the podium,
yes.
And so we could get it recorded.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Which little machine?
The little machine.
Oh.
Wow. Okay. No, you're Mr. Noriega then?
Yes.
That'd be terrific. Thank you.
Yeah.